Welcome to the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you haven't joined us before, we're passionate about all things internal medicine and helping you become the best tech you can be. We'll be discussing interesting internal medicine diseases, how to work closely with pet parents, and how to become the go-to tech in your practice. Now, let's start the show. Welcome back, everybody. Thank you for listening and making a commitment to your learning. We hope that you're doing well. I'm Yvonne Brandenburg, not joined by Jordan, because if you listened to last week's, you'll understand this is part two of this episode because Christine Weaver, who's here with me, and I really like talking. If you don't know who Christine is, she joined us for last week's episode, which was 193. This is going to be 194. Christine, you got two hours with us. Whoop, whoop. Hi, Christine. You just giggle. You don't want to say hi. You're like, nope, that's it. All right, so Christine Weaver, just in case you didn't hear it last week, we'll continue. So Christine Weaver, LVT, VTS in neurology. She's super smart. She has had her VTS in neurology since 2012. She's got her bachelor's in biobehavioral health, which is what really plays into these conversations as well, because she did a lot of learning with that during her time in school. And she used to work with me, but currently, I love this title, so I'm going to keep saying it. Currently, she's the learning and development trailblazer for Partner Veterinary Emergency and Specialty. Welcome back this week. Hey.
Hey. I am happy to be back. And I hope my hope is that the most important thing that people remember from last week is, of course, that the Velociraptors in Jurassic Park were, in fact, Deinonychus, not Velociraptor.
That is the most important part. Yes.
Yeah. My personal thing is I'm guessing it's closer to a Utah Raptor, but yeah, I do think that if that was one of the key takeaways.
That was the key too.
No, not really. My hope genuinely is that what people got from last week is, of course, that science is really important, and that even when we learn, sometimes when we're wrong, we're it's always in that pursuit of truth.
Yeah.
And that it sucks being wrong. We don't like knowing that we truly believed something to be true when it truly was not. But that is life. And that's how we move forward and come together to get closer to the truth. And one of those ways, of course, that we can soak up the most, you know, up-to-date information is to be looking at scientific literature, to be reading the most up-to-date literature, which can be hard. Or we go to conferences where our presenters should be leveraging scientific literature and evidence-based information for you to be able to digest. So I kind of consider conferences to be kind of like secondary literature in a way.
Which I think depends on the conference. That's an interesting...
I guess, so I'm thinking of ACVIM Forum. We'll talk a little bit more. So I know today we are going to talk about statistics. It's going to be very brief. We're not going to talk about t-tests. And, you know, this is typically when I would tell people to lock the doors. Don't let people run out. But it's not that painful.
Please listen to this episode is what you're saying.
Please listen. And really, the statistics, we're just going to give definitions. And in the proceedings that are on the website, I have the glossary of definitions. So if you're really that bothered by stats, you know, don't skip over it, but you know, there's no Twitter. Because there are things that you're going to see if you're like, hopefully at this point, you're like, yeah, okay, I should read more scientific literature because I do want to be a presenter, or I want to be a writer, or I want my VTS application, or you're like me and you're just like, I want to learn. I've definitely gone down the rabbit hole of paleo neurobiology because I thought it was fun. I don't expect everybody to think that way, but I think it's important for those of us who truly believe and truly have that love of learning that this is just some basic stuff to be able to read about and understand what we talk about when we say p-value or type 2 error or things like that.
Well, not only that, but like, I think of it when I'm, because we joked in the last episode that I'm smart, but I'm not like as smart, I think, as people think I am. I'm just really good at finding answers, you know, which is researching. And I think, when I because I use Google. That's my jam, right? And
Lord, we'll talk about that.
I know, but like at the same time, when I am doing that, I'm also evaluating the source, right? And it's like,
Yes.
is it Susie's superspectacular.com? Like, I'm gonna be really skeptical versus like, it is an, what is it, NHI dot blah, 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 blah. Like, I'm gonna look at that and understand, is it a primary, is it a secondary, is it tertiary, which is what we talked about last week. And that could be for any subject. It doesn't even have to be veterinary medicine. It's just like, like I joke, Chris, Jordan and I are super into chickens. I know, right? Christine's holding up her little I was gonna call them diorama, but your little figurines,
It
which
was, yeah, it's an ankylosaur. That is my spirit animal, by the way.
But Jordan and I, we joke because, like, I'm learning about chickens. I've never had chickens before, and Christine gets spammed with my chicken pictures all the time now. Because they are tiny T-Rexes, I think. I don't know.
Closest living relative to the T-Rex. You're welcome.
There you go. See, they're tiny T-Rexes. They look like little T-Rexes. It's really funny. But like I will go and seek out information, just like basic information. But I use the scientific method and like understanding where my resources are coming from. Like, is it coming from a reputable source, or is it coming from something that's not reputable with zero references? Like, if it's a website that is Susie whatever dot com, but they have like the resources listed, then I'm like, oh, okay, you've done your research and it's like a proceeding paper, right? Versus like it's just all opinion and there's nothing backing it up. And so, and that's something where when you're learning about anything, whatever subject you're going through, it is really important to be able to evaluate your sources and make sure you can find. And you touched on this last week too, is, are you seeing sources on both sides of the fence, and
Yes.
ha like your pros and your cons for whatever thing you're looking up, versus, is that research like 70 years old versus is it in the last 5 years, right? And so that's why, we talked about doing these, is because we need to be able to evaluate where that information is coming from and have it be appropriate and not fall down some crazy rabbit holes. I mean, you
Well,
can rabbit hole. Just make sure that whatever rabbit hole you're diving into is the rabbit hole you want to go down.
yeah, definitely. Like I, 1,000% everybody should be into paleoneurobiology. But no, you're
Christine,
absolutely right.
don't be offended by this, but I'm not sure I'm ever gonna go there.
Click, done.
I was gonna say, do they have paleogastroenterology? Like,
Probably.
I'll go down that
You go
rabbit
down that one. We'll have a whole like just vet tech paleo like series or
Oh
something
my
like that.
God. Again, if there's
If you
people out
guys
there
want
listening who's super
it.
into it, it's called We'll Get You in Touch with Christine. Oh my God, I love it. Sorry. Anyways.
No, you're absolutely right. And crap testing is one of those things that we can do. I'm going to go over some things. And again, the statistics is really just so you understand what you're reading, not to use it to evaluate what's in front of you. I just want to make sure you guys understand what's going to be put in front of you, particularly when you're reading primary and some secondary research. I want you to understand association versus causation, because a lot of people, a lot of research, that's kind of the name of the game, is they're trying to establish relationships, whether it's this drug is effective or this lifestyle or this certain health behavior has a good effect versus a bad effect. I want people to, and you read that stuff all the time. Like one day cancer is caused by coffee. The next day it's eggs. Next time it's because you breathe.
Right.
And then they're going to like, it bounces all over the place. So
or
I want
that
people
new
to
miracle thing. And then like 6 months later, they're like, oh, look at all these side effects. And you're like,
Absolutely. But you're absolutely right. And so I want people to understand those things again, because not because I want them to be experts at it, but I want you guys to at least, like I said, science is in part skeptical. We should be asking questions. So I don't want to encourage something like, oh, I read this article, so I have to believe everything that's in it. I want us to understand and be able to
use educated questions, right? Like if you can understand it, you can be there's that you can be skeptical to be skeptical. Oh my God. I don't know why all of a sudden I can't say the word, but anyways, versus are you using like a scientific method reasoning to be skeptical? Like that's very different. And like, it's funny because like, I will have conversations with people who are not in veterinary medicine and, you know, there's some thing that we're discussing and I still will use like the scientific, like skeptical part because I'm like, okay, but why are we looking at it this way? And it's true. It's like, I'm very skeptical, but at the same time, I'm also like super optimistic about things.
Yes.
Right. And so it doesn't mean that you're skeptical and negative. You can still be skeptical, but really be hopeful and optimistic and just be like, because and I think this is where for me it's like a healthy skepticism where it's like it doesn't have to be doom and gloom, right? It could be, look at this amazing thing that comes from it, right? And so I think
that's
understanding
how I see
truth. That too, right, is part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. If you are skeptical, we kind of, like we briefly touched upon last week, is that kind of psychological notion that if I perceive you to be on the same page as me, in some ways, I'm going to be a lot less skeptical of you,
right,
what you have to say. And I might be overly accepting when I shouldn't be. Vice versa, if I don't view you as somebody who aligns with me and my perspective and values, I might be overly skeptical, unreasonably skeptical. That's not using our scientific method. That's using our emotions.
Right.
And that's using something unrelated. And so I look at different things and different statements separately. I work with some people that they'll be like, oh, I heard this one podcast or this one expert and they say this. And so it must be that. And I was like, well, it's expert opinion. Yes, right. But it's an expert. And I'm like, yes, it is an expert. And I trust that expert is incredibly intelligent and has good reason to say what they say. But in a time right now, when you talk about people wanting clickbait, you've got influencers, you've got all these people that just want you to click on their site. And then you have the algorithms coming in, meaning you're only seeing hive-minded things.
Yeah.
You're not seeing the things that otherwise come in. We become a lot less, we just assume this is the way it is because social media and other, you know, like you said, Google will even filter out things that doesn't seem to align with what you like to look at.
Which is hilarious because this podcast in and of itself is exactly that. But at the same time, like, this is why when people come up to me and they're like, oh my God, I'm like, just because Jordan and I say things on the podcast, one, doesn't make it an absolute truth. Mm-hmm. It's just like, we've done some research. And so we're doing a presentation on it. But you know, we're looking at over 4 years worth of information. And how long did you say medical information is relevant nowadays? 5 years?
But that's an estimate. That's
depending
not
on what we're talking about. So like some of those earlier podcast episodes, like Jordan and I have talked about it, like we need to revamp some of them because there have been medical improvements. Speaking of, we will have a call to speakers page for that specifically because there's some smart people that listen to the podcast and we're going to leverage you and your brain.
That's why I'm like, do I want to be on a podcast? Like, I'm smart enough to do this, but you give me a platform to talk about stuff, including dinosaurs. I'm done. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. And so I think that's, you know, all that stuff is really important. And then this week we'll dive into stats. So I'll let you dive into that.
I will keep it short and painless.
And I'll try not to gloss over, I promise.
And don't gloss over. I get it. It's dry. It really is dry. And it is a shame that you guys can't see the visuals when I start talking about how we look at association versus causation, because I've got some good stuff up there. But that's why I have a glossary.
I might just talk you into doing like an actual course with this information. Because it is hard when you don't have those visuals.
Yeah.
I have the benefit of the visuals, you guys.
But you know, as we dive in, and I have the glossary, so if you guys have the proceedings, you can at least look. When we talk about p-value, covariation, Pearson's R, so you'll at least have those so that if you're reading primary research, you kind of understand when they start giving the results or the discussion with their p-values and limitations and everything. So I'll kind of go quickly, and I do apologize about that, but I also don't want to dwell on things when I don't have good visuals to say, see, this is what an R of -9 looks like.
Right.
Or, sorry, -0.9. That was really dumb. Yeah, I'm a smart person. Or this is what, you know, an R of 0 looks like, you know, so it's much easier with the visuals, but so that's why I'll kind of gloss over it. But I do want you to kind of at least hear the concepts, because how we use vocabulary, it's very specific vocabulary means specific things. So like when we're talking about like a population versus a sample, you know, the population is the entirety of what you want to apply results to. So if I want to run a test, I have a question that would apply to all dogs all over the face of the planet, right? There is no possible way I can gather every dog on the face of the planet, but holy God, what a great day.
So much fun.
So even the mean ones, don't care. I'd love it. So the way that you want to try and answer that question is that when you do the research, you're going to do it on what's called a sample. General rule of thumb, the bigger the sample, the more reliable your results are going to be. But that sample also should be representative of your population. So if I'm trying to study every dog on the face of the planet, but I choose 500 dachshunds, I'm going to miss my mark. Yeah. My research might be very good. I might have done things correct and ethically, but can I truly do what we call generalizability, which means take the information that I got out of my study and generalize it back out to the population, which for me would be that entire population of dogs. The answer is no. Dachshunds are mutants. That'd be like using French bulldogs. Like, no,
I was going to say, like, you could say this is true for dachshunds.
Yeah.
But not every species of dog. Or
you're exactly right. Yeah. And so that's the importance of the sample. So when you're reading through things and they say how they got their sample, how they got their sample and what their sample is absolutely will influence your results. If I put out, let's say you're studying people, and I put out a bunch of flyers saying like, hey, we're looking for volunteers for XYZ. You're now only getting people involved in the study who are like, I think being involved in a study is a good thing. Or people who have the opportunity to not be at work, people who have the resources that can drive to a facility. So now you're all of a sudden that sample, even though it seems really great and you could get a variety of people, you're still kind of canceling out certain socioeconomic statuses and geographical locations.
Yeah.
So it gets kind of tricky when we talk about wanting to make sure that sample is generalizable, but those are things that I want people to think about. Did this sample really seem like it represents the population at large that these researchers wanted to study? So we talk about generalizability, just being like, can you generalize the results out to a greater population? Which to me, although I could be wrong on this, so I apologize, it's kind of synonymous with what we say is external validity, which is are your results valid to the external world? And we talk about internal versus external validity. So internal validity means your research was good, your numbers are good, your process was good, your results are 1,000% accurate. Just because you have good internal validity doesn't mean you can have good external validity and generalize it to the greater population, because it depends on a number of different factors, which includes your study design, your sample, how you collected your sample, all of that. And so again, that becomes important because a lot of times research is trying to establish some kind of a relationship, typically like a cause effect. So most commonly you're going to think of are like your clinical trials where they're trying to say this drug is effective against this disease, or you are going to look and say, you know, this particular health behavior, you know, improves or is of a detriment to somebody's quality of life or what have you. So it's very common. And so whenever you read things, and it's every other week, something else causes cancer. So this is important because I want people to understand that covariation, correlation, association are not the same as causation. We know that both implicitly and explicitly. We all know the saying causation, correlation is not causation.
Right.
So when we talk about things like a relationship, right? So an association is just really any relationship between two variables. Any and all. It doesn't mean that they're actually related. And we'll talk about that in a second. It just means that there is a relationship. And a correlation is going to be specific to like your quantitative variables. We talked about last week, qualitative versus quantitative research. But for our numbers, we can actually create a linear graph to show how closely related our variables are. And if you think of rise over run, right? Rise over run. So, you know, you have that kind of one-to-one relationship, and that's a very linear relationship. But when we have a lot of different scatter of data, how closely it resembles a line versus just, you know, an explosion of dots all over a graph can tell us how closely associated these variables are.
Right.
So in general, the closer to one or negative one that line is, the line of best fit that goes through that data, the more closely related they are.
Yeah.
And so we talk about strength and direction. If it's a positive number, it means as one variable goes up, the other variable goes up. If it's a negative number, so like a negative one, means that as one variable goes up, the other one goes down, basically. So it's an inverse versus positive relationship or direct relationship.
Yeah.
And so again, this is where the graphs come in really nicely, but imagine if you will, a lot of dots that are either seemingly chaotic on an X and Y axis versus ones that look very closely related to being on a line.
And you guys have seen these. These are like those, if you know nothing about statistics, you know, it's the square with the dots in it with an X and a Y axis. And you're just like, what does that mean? You know?
Yeah. And so
that's usually what I do.
Yeah. And you can see, it's a way to even just visually say, whoa, these two things are not related at all. Or, ooh, they look very strongly related.
Yeah.
And your p-value is another really important thing that you're going to see. And it's just the probability of the results that these researchers got being due to random chance. So for obvious reasons, we want that number to be as low as possible. If you get a p-value of like 0.26, that means that there's a 26% chance that the results they got were due to random chance. That's pretty high.
That's, I don't like that. Way high.
Yeah. So in general, we like it to be 0.05 or lower, or a 5% or lower chance. But honestly, the lower the number, the less likely the results are due to random chance. Now, that does not eliminate the possibility of what we call a confounding variable. So your results, and that's where we start talking about association not necessarily being causation. And so you'll see in papers where they talk about a type 1 versus type 2 error. And that's usually because it's either random chance or there's a confounding variable out there that we haven't taken into account. And that's messed with our results. And I have great examples of this. People are probably already thinking of one of the examples that I brought up, but your type one is going to be I call it a false positive, which basically means you thought you had these amazing results, or maybe your p-value was 0.03, not due to random chance. This has got to be good stuff. But in the end of the day, it wasn't. That's known as a type one error. So even if everything goes perfectly, you could still get a type one error. It's still science. Nobody was trying to lie. It's just either random chance or a confounding variable we couldn't think of.
And confounding variable, just so you guys get, is just like an outside influence. Like you didn't take that into consideration, but it's having an effect.
Yeah. And I do have slides on that because I have some really great examples of things that I love. I love it. And really great websites to take you guys to have even greater examples. Your type two error is just the opposite. So you thought you did not have kind of groundbreaking results, but it turns out in reality you did. So maybe you got a p-value of that 0.26, but at the end of the day, something happened and actually this relationship is real. What you found was real, just for whatever reason, your results made it sound like it's not.
Right.
And again, confounding variable is one way that this can happen. And it's just a variable that's not part of the study, but influences the results,
right.
Just as she had said. So you'll oftentimes see that the researchers said, we controlled for, and that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to control for confounding variables. And some of that could be if they're trying to do, let's say, a research on like cancer.
Mm-hmm.
They might try to find an influence on cancer of some sort. So they're going to control for things like age. They're going to control for things like maybe sex.
Mm-hmm.
There's certain things that they're going to try and control for so that those things don't influence the final results. And no, I'm not going to explain how they do that because that's getting down the rabbit hole of statistics that nobody wants to hear about. So as we are moving forward in relationships, let's take 5 hot seconds to talk about association, correlation, and causation, confounding variables, and why we, even when somebody tries to tell us this causes this, we should still be skeptical. So number one, in order for there to be causation, there must be an association. Duh. If you don't have an association, they don't cause an effect. It just, you don't have it. The other thing that's kind of a duh is the supposed cause must precede the effect. Period, end of story. The cause has to come before the effect. So in that situation, what we want to see is that researchers are trying to rule out what is caused reverse or bidirectional correlation, meaning that we thought that X caused Y, but in fact, Y causes X. And that's that relationship. Or X and Y bounce off each other and they're influencing each other all the time, which would be bidirectional. So those are the things we have to rule out. Researchers should also make an attempt to rule out other explanations, right? Like, so if your explanation for why the moon is there is because, you know what? I can't even find a ridiculous thing of that. Basically, they just need to...
Because cheese was thrown into outer space.
Yes. That's your reasoning. Of course, that makes sense. Why wouldn't it? But really, the causal variable can explain or the change, or at least is the best or simplest explanation. So if you have to come up with this absolutely ridiculous explanation as to why one thing causes the other, and it's so many contingencies, I'm immediately losing my interest in whether or not there's a causative relationship variables. Because I'm like,
right. Well, because in the 1900s, the mice got together and left the boats with their cheese, and they built a rocket ship and shot their cheese out into outer space.
Yes. I mean, obviously, that was the answer. We come up with stupid astronomical stuff.
You and I can have a debate about that because...
We're not going to, because we're going to talk about science. Anyway, no.
I can throw science into that, my friend.
I'm kidding. Like, I'm always skeptical, but I always have an open mind as well. And then the last thing that, and this is what people usually... don't like about this is there needs to be a plausible mechanism of action or explanation for how it happens. So people who just kind of come up with these random associations but don't have a plausible explanation, I kind of go, well, this just keep going down the rabbit hole and come find me when you actually have an explanation for whatever it is you're talking about.
I mean, cheese needed to go in outer space.
Yeah, I mean, clearly. And so for me, I would come back to you and say, where's the evidence that they built rockets? And of course, your response would be like, well, clearly the rockets are on the moon now, Christine. Like, I've already explained this.
Hello. How do you think it got up there? They had to have rockets.
I mean, see, and this is what I'm talking about. These are the kinds of like circular conversations people have on social media, which is why you don't find me on social media. Other things to remember. As we kind of briefly talked about last time, you know, no single observational study is going to imply causation. And really, the more studies we have done, even if they're all experiments, they're all randomized controlled trials, the closer it is that we can get to implying causation. And that includes observational. Like I said, we did not give people cigarettes and tell them to smoke their whole life.
I mean,
They did it on their own. Yes, that people chose their own control and treatment groups in that. But, you know, so we can get there with observation. It just takes a long time.
Right.
And you have to use observational studies for certain unethical questions that we may need to answer. Now, you can imply causation in an experimental study, particularly if you have a randomized controlled trial. I'm very conservative, though, because like I said, that p-value, I don't care that it's 0.03. That's still a 3% chance. That's random chance. I'd like to see these studies done over and over and over again. And when those kinds of studies are done over and over and over again, then that lends itself well into things like systematic reviews and meta-analyses, where we have a huge amount of information that can become more reliable. Yeah. And the last thing that I think is really important is it's never possible to ensure 100% that there is a causal relationship. We can be pretty close. We can be pretty certain. But it really, when you're of a scientific mindset, almost nothing is 100% certain. And again, that kind of gets back to our philosophical mindset. But that's why things are frequently proven wrong. That's why we come back, we test, we retest, and it turns out asbestos shouldn't be inhaled. I'm sure Judy Garland had a great freaking set of lungs after having asbestos rain down on her during Wizard of Oz. I mean, sound like a great idea at the time, but you know.
Wait, what?
They used asbestos, you know, that scene in Wizard of Oz when they're in the poppies fields and it's like snowing and everything. That's asbestos. That's just pure asbestos. They're raining down on people. Yeah. They didn't know. That's my point.
That's so sad.
No better, do better. Let's not throw asbestos on actors and actresses anymore. Thank you.
Especially not Mrs. Judy Garland.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she went out a different way, but I have an idea if she didn't go out that way. It was probably lung cancer. So imagine, if you will, a chart that charts ice cream sales and shark attacks.
I love this.
Seems ridiculous, but this is the one we all know about. And you can Google this anytime, guys. Google ice cream sales, shark attacks, or home invasions and ice cream sales. These things are very closely associated. It is a positive relationship, meaning that as ice cream sales go up, so too do shark attacks.
Because now it seems ridiculous. In the summer.
Exactly. So you're confounding. I was getting there.
That means I'm listening.
So when we go through this, and when you see something that you're like, wait a minute, what? This is why I want to train you guys to think. It's an extreme example, but what is the mechanism of action?
Yeah, but there's so many times that you'll see stuff like that. And people are like, here you go. And you're like, wait, but that's no.
I look at this, and what you can't see on the slide is that it's just a chart. There's no R, right? So I don't know the strength of this relationship. Is it really closely related, or is it not really closely related?
Right.
I don't see a p-value. What is the even thought that this could be due to random chance? It is, by the way.
Yeah.
What are the references? Where did they get these numbers? And lastly, could there be a confounding variable? And as you said, Yvonne, the confounding variable is warm weather.
Yeah.
As it gets hotter, people go to the beach. You go to the beach, you get a shark attack, potentially.
Yeah.
Same thing with ice cream sales. Unless you're like my boyfriend and I, oh, best time to buy ice cream is the winter. You can get some really good ice cream for dirt cheap. Tillamook, woo! But most people, most smart people don't do that. And we're just cheap and love ice cream.
Yeah.
But another one, and this is another one that I really like to show in the presentation, which, and she's already laughing, it's the per capita cheese consumption and the number of people who died by becoming tangled in their bed sheets. Once again, you're sitting there, what is even the mechanism of action? The answer is none.
None, but they're very, like their numbers are very close.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
So this graph, by the way, there's cheese in pounds on the left-hand side. And then the years are the right-hand side. And as the pounds of cheese consumed goes up, so does the number of deaths by bedsheet.
Just wait till PETA gets their hands on this information. Apologies to anybody out there who loves PETA.
I think if they love PETA, they're not listening to this podcast.
Don't be so divisionist.
I'm not divisionist. I
don't find PETA to be evidence-based, so I don't like them. But that's because they're not evidence-based.
Yeah, and I feel like they're not going to be treating animals with veterinary medicine.
No, they've been actually known not to.
Yeah.
But
if you are a PETA person,
I support you. If you're passionate about something, even if I don't agree with you, I support you being passionate about something that gives you meaning. Because if you have meaning, you're going to be a more positive person. If you're a more positive person, you're not going to be an asshole. So go for it. Be passionate.
I think there's a relationship. I think you're missing something.
So the
Just
study I
because
was
you're
talking,
passionate about something does not mean you're not going to be an
if you
asshole.
have meaning, if you have meaning,
If you
so
have
you can be
meaning,
passionate
does
about something and
not.
not have meaning. But we can that study I
Anyways.
mentioned from Finland, we can discuss offline because it is something very similar to that. But more importantly, the more cheese you eat, the more likely you're going to die in bed sheets. No,
I
the chart
mean, 33 pounds of cheese
is a
is a lot
beautiful
of
start to the day.
cheese.
Yes, it's a beautiful start to the day. But the correlation here is 0.947. So basically 0.95. You don't get much closer. These two things are very closely related.
That is pretty
But
insane.
what is not listed on this chart is the p-value. So it doesn't indicate to me, like, yes, clearly this is weirdly very closely associated, but I have no idea if this is due to random chance. I also have no idea what the mechanism of action is here. I personally am racking my brain about confounding variables at this point, but it does show down there that the resources that they use to get the data is the US Department of Agriculture and the CDC. So I'm like, okay.
That's
So
interesting.
this is a really great lesson. So this comes from a website that I highly encourage people to Google because it's fun as hell. It's called Spurious Correlations. There's even a book out there, and it's tons of this weird data. It's like the number of Nicolas Cage movies released and people dying by drowning in their pool. It's so weird, but it's a great lesson. And I think it's a great exercise for people to go through to really understand that, like, just because they're associated doesn't mean there's any causation. And then the last chart I usually go over with people is the most disturbing because it's a
Yeah.
chart on autism diagnoses and organic food sales. And I like this one because this is the most likely thing you're going to find when you're reading literature, right? Like, you're going to find something
Yeah.
that's not like cheese and bed sheets. Like, that doesn't even make sense. Or shark attacks and ice cream. Those are very obvious. I like to use those as exercises to get people to think, like, well, that's clearly ridiculous. I want people to approach all information like this to say, to be skeptical, not ridiculous, but skeptical. And so what you can see on this chart is there is the association on it is 0.9971. You don't get much closer to one than that. These two are very, very closely positively related, meaning as autism diagnoses go up, so too do organic food sales, right? The other thing that you can't see on this chart is the p-value is 0.0001, meaning that the likelihood that these two things are related this way is unlikely to be due to chance. Still can be, but it's unlikely to be due to chance. The list of all of the organizations from which they got the data is listed below. And I am not, and this is why I said this in the last podcast, I am not suggesting organic food causes autism. I'm not. What I'm saying is that when I look at this, I go, it doesn't make sense. You know, if somebody's trying to pitch to me that organic food causes autism, I'm like, I need to know your mechanism of action, one. But two, this is where I start to think about reverse or bidirectional correlation. Could it very well be that as people are more aware of more and more autism diagnoses, more and more people are moving to organic foods? And is it also possible that it's bidirectional? So as we see more autism, we see more organic foods. We see, and as the autism diagnoses keep going up, more and more people are switching their lifestyles to organic foods. So this is, I like to use this as an example of the potential of reverse or bidirectional correlation. So just because somebody pitches this to you and says, well, clearly organic food causes autism,
It could be
maybe
that autism causes organic food.
sales.
Like,
Yes. Yeah. And I know that sounds really weird. Like, why would autism cause that? But I think also, and there's more to it, particularly with this example, as we're getting better and better and understanding more neurodivergent type diagnoses, those diagnoses are going to go up. But as those diagnoses go up, people are getting further and further away from processed foods and excess chemicals and other things like that. So, again, I just want to make clear, I'm not suggesting don't buy organic food, your kids are going to have autism. Like, that's just not at all what I'm saying. I just like to use these as for illustrative effects. And, you know, the importance here is that a lot of research that you're going to read is going to have graphs. They're going to try and infer some kind of relationship. And so it's important to remain skeptical, because if we just assume there's causation, one, there may not be causation. You may be implementing medical practices or treatment practices that aren't actually true because we assumed causation when really there was just a relationship.
Well, and I was going to say that kind of goes back to the autism and the organic sales. It's like, well, which one came first?
Yep.
Right.
That is a chicken or the egg. Yep.
Like, if you're thinking about it negatively, you're like, oh my God, organic food sales, that's causing autism, versus the positive side of that is, oh, look, autism diagnosis is leading to people having more organic food sales. So it really is like not just that relationship, but our interpretation, which is huge.
You bring up the best point yet, which is statistics out of context is gobbledygook.
Yep.
And so when somebody presents you with just straight up statistics, and then they're trying to tell you the story around it, then I also start to say, I'd like to know more about the confounding variables. I'd like to know, like, a confounding variable for that is an increase in the testing ability for neurodivergent syndromes and conditions.
Yeah.
It's just, it goes
and
so
the
far
labeling
beyond
of
it.
Things
So,
as organic.
All that
Like,
chart
we didn't
is
have to do
numbers.
that before. You know, it's like, it's all that sort of stuff. Yeah.
And that's the whole point of the Spurious Correlations website as well, is that they're just numbers. He just took numbers together, put them together, and found strong associations. And that's his whole point, is that out of context, what does this even mean? And that's, and it helps kind of train us to be a little bit more skeptical. And I don't mean unreasonably skeptical. I just think if they can't account for confounding variables in the research, plus, you know, they didn't control for those, they're, you know, what is it? Reverse versus bidirectional correlation. What is the mechanism of action? What is there a simple explanation, or are they going off the charts with what it must mean? Like, those are all things to think about with in terms of critical thinking around statistics. But yeah, so you got to think about those things. Is the relationship what it seems to be? Is this just completely out of context? That's why you just don't look at numbers, put them on a chart and go, yep, that's what that means.
Right.
And really where you're going to find a lot of that stuff is in like the primary research. That's usually, now you're going to find it in like some secondary as well, but most often it's going to be the primary research, where their whole idea is, I have this hypothesis, or they're trying to test a theory. Those two things are not interchangeable, by the way. And so they've created a research project to try and test that. So again, when we look at the primary research, we're looking at an IMRAD. So this is going to be very in-depth about a very specific research project. And I know that makes it sound little, like research projects are huge. So it's not like what we did in school. This kind of research, and it takes years to get it published. It has to go through, when it's reputable, it has to go through peer reviews and things like that. So I find that these can be very hard to read at times. And although the entire article is going to be very important for you to read, I will look at the quote unquote Cliff's Notes, which is usually the abstract summary, discussion, and conclusion. Not because I don't care about their materials and methods. I will look at that because I do want to know what study design they used, but I am not qualified to understand and evaluate exactly if they did it right or not. So I'd rather say, okay, yep, they did this study design. Yes, they were open and transparent about their limitations and how they did it. And here's what they came to. So it's oftentimes what I do. And we went over last time that these kinds of projects or these kinds of articles and research can be prospective or retrospective. They can be observational or experimental, and they can be quantitative or qualitative. And so in even within each of those categories, you have tons of study designs. So I don't want to overwhelm people, but there are a few very common ones that I wanted to go over, like lab animal ones, lab and animal models. Stephen, please don't hate me for this, but lab and animal models are very good because they have extraordinarily good, what we call internal validity. Again, they've controlled for everything. This is a highly controlled environment. Those results are absolutely going to be accurate if performed correctly to that research, to that experiment. But the problem with them is that, one, they're highly controlled. That does not represent your average dog. It does not represent your average person. I live in all kinds of different things where the environment affects me. My, you know, where I live could be air pollution, how much I have to drive. Do I sit? Do I not sit? What was my upbringing like? So those kinds of things you can't really kind of interject into these kinds of studies. And further, if they're doing like a rat model, or I mean, rat or mouse model, but you want to study dogs, that's not even the same species. Now, these are not mice and rats you find in a field. They're highly, highly bred to the point where they can breed them with and without certain genes so that they can study certain diseases.
Yep.
But how often do you hear about, oh, great breakthrough in this research for Alzheimer's disease or this, that disease? And then they go into human trials and all of a sudden nothing works. Part of that is because rats and mice aren't people, but this is a great starting point for a lot of that kind of research, because now you have kind of this proof of concept. So it's very it's considered very low level for things like medical decisions. But again, very, I like to follow these because I go, well, that's interesting. I'm going to keep my eye on that for the next few years as that goes through the next, because that's the other thing about literature is that you might post or you might publish one research, and then these researchers may continue to follow up with different study designs as they try and get further or closer to the truth. So I like lab animal models. They're just, I don't hang your hat on them unless it's the target population. So again, right, if I'm looking at ALS, and a great example of that is they studied disc disease and being deep pain negative in dogs. Well, they studied it in mice, but they don't get disc disease. So they just snip their spinal cords and you're like, okay, okay. Well, the problem is dogs don't do that. They get discs.
That's not how that works.
Yeah. And that's why a lot of translational models for things like ALS haven't worked out. But now that we can use dogs as a translational model, dogs get kind of their own natural form of degenerative myelopathy. People get their own form of ALS. They're not the exact same, but they're pretty close. So that's one example of an animal model that gets us at least a little bit closer as opposed to like a rat or mouse model. And again, when I say low level for medical decisions, still extremely important research, still really cool to read. Just don't hang your hat on it. You find something like this one is the example I have up is oral CBD prevents allodynia and neurological dysfunctions in a mouse model of mild traumatic brain injury. Cool. I'm not going to go start giving all my dogs CBD saying, oh, well, you got a mild TBI and research shows shows it in mice. But
right.
RCTs or randomized control trials, this is the big one everybody knows of. This is how we approve drugs. This is how we do a number of things. This is another RCT with regards to CBD in dogs. So this is a great one. It's prospective, it's experimental, so they were able to manipulate variables. It's quantitative. It had good internal validity, as randomized control trials do. They do have some good degree of external validity as well, especially if you're using your sample in, you know, your sample is taken from the general population that you're looking to study. In this case, they use dogs and their target population was dogs. So in general, RCTs are considered the gold standard for determining causation. But I, again, because I'm a very conservative person in this light, I'd like to see a few RCTs on the same subject before I really start hanging my hat on it. Because again, random chance. And again, so when you think of any drug you've ever taken that's gone through the FDA, this is the kind of stuff that they do. And I won't go into how FDA does their clinical trials, but that's an interesting story as well. Crossover designs are cool. Like you have, as we kind of, you have a treatment group and you have your kind of control group. You do a treatment to the treatment group. You have a washout period and then both groups switch sides. So essentially both groups get to be in the treatment, both get to be in the control. So you might see a crossover design for, you know, if they're trying to control for like internal individual factors. I don't see these as much, but as I was looking around and what I have on here is a study on dogs, but it is just kind of a cool study. If you see crossovers, it can control for those even just granular internal factors or individual factors. On the side of like observational studies is what we all know and love, which are case reports. Case reports are done by us as VTS applicants. they are really, really good for highlighting unique and weird cases or diagnostics or treatments, but which does not align with our VTS application. So I just want to highlight that that's very different. But so typically these are going to be, because it's an N of one, or you have such a small sample, you're going to say like, hey, by the way, I saw this really cool case. One of the cases that I highlight on mine is one that, you know, one of the hospitals I used to work at did, which was we used EEG to identify and diagnose non-convulsive status epilepticus. So that was a case report. We described one case. We described in detail what we did. But case reports cannot infer causation, and no responsible case report writer will. So it's really just saying, hey, this is kind of cool. We actually found a really interesting thing with EEG. Maybe we should investigate this further. So sometimes this, again, can be a good jumping off point for, you know, negotiations into additional research and getting closer to that truth. And sometimes they evolve into case series, which is what our hospital did. We then turned one EEG case into a case series looking for prognostic factors found on EEG. So again, we're describing in detail what we did, how we collected our data, but we're not inferring causation necessarily. We might say, these are risk factors that we found, and it's good to be able to identify risk factors because that can then lead to the next study, which evaluates whether or not these risk factors are actually valid, or if they're confounding variables that we couldn't identify because this is an observational study where we can't control or manipulate any of the variables. And then you have like cohort and cross-sectional design. So cohort is really going to track, you have subjects and you're going to track them over time with multiple time points. Your cross-sectional studies, you just have one time point where you are studying them. So for cohort studies, they're good if you're trying to establish cause comes before the hypothesized effect. Like as we said, if we want to infer causation, that's one of the things we have to establish. And these are good for common diseases, you know, in people, things like cardiovascular disease. In the study that I have highlighted on the slide that you can't see, it's the age at which dogs are neutered and then the risk of becoming overweight or obese and orthopedic injury secondary to it. So these people that did the study were not trying to say at this age, if you neuter them, they're going to end up like this. It's more like it looks like if you neuter them at this age, their risk of these diseases increases or decreases. Whereas your cross-sectional, again, is good for identifying risk factors, but again, it's just one time point analysis as opposed to several time point analyses. And in the human world, the most famous study for the cohort studies, so tracking them over time, is the Whitehall cardiovascular studies. And secondary research, so that's all primary study designs. They can be hard to read. They're hard for me to read, and I had to read a ton of them in school, and I still love to read them regardless. But secondary is a lot easier. And so I'm going to go over just briefly narrative reviews versus systematic reviews versus meta-analyses. So narrative reviews are just as they sound, right? Like it's a review that goes in depth in one topic. And we say narrative because it's written typically by one or two people. There's no IMRAD. They don't have to be transparent about what resources they used, how they included some resources and excluded others. So although this is very good, they should be written by experts, there's a little bit more chance of bias, because if I want to tell you EEG is the best diagnostic tool out there for your hospitals, whether you're neuro or ECC, I could choose to just eliminate resources that would argue my point. And then it makes my narrative review sound greater. It's unethical and it shouldn't be done. But that isn't to say that it doesn't happen. And that's why I like systematic reviews, because systematic reviews do include that IMRAP. They will tell you specifically, these are the studies in the research that we included. This is what we excluded, and here's why we excluded it. So it's a little bit more in mind, depending on the review, feels a little bit more sciencey. It feels more like a primary research. It's just more transparent. So there's less chance of bias, but you can never eliminate bias either, because they're written by people. And even if it's written by AI, that gets all its information from stuff people put on the interwebs. So you cannot get rid of bias. And then meta-analysis is very similar to your like systematic reviews, because it's using multiple research, primary research that's out there, It collects them and puts them in an IMRAB style. And it's basically crunching statistics upon statistics upon statistics. So if you have one study that has an N of 100, another study that has an N of 50, and another study that has an N of 100, individually, those sample sizes may not be very big, but when I combine them to 250 and then combine all the statistics from that, my information becomes more powerful. My sample size is much greater. So systematic reviews and meta-analyses, if you can find the research you need on the topics you need using a systematic review or meta-analyses, that's what I use. And if I can't, it means that there is a limitation of primary research on that topic, which means we're still trying to figure out the truth. There's a lot of research that's out there. I went over a lot of study designs, quick and dirty. You're going to use primary research if you're trying to cite very specific statistics from a specific study and some very, very pointed information. Secondary, I find, is really great research when you're trying to do some presentation, you know, on a topic. So that's, again, typically what I'm going to use, because I don't have to read 500 studies. Somebody read 500 studies, put it into one article, and was very transparent as to what went in and what didn't. I'm going to use that. And tertiary is like your textbooks, again, really good for just basic information. So if you are giving a presentation, making client education brochures, or you're educating a newer technicians or assistants in your hospital, just the good basic facts you can find in a textbook works really, really well. And one of the things I'll give Yvonne to put up on the website is the hierarchy of how reliable certain studies are over others. And what you can't see on here is that towards the bottom are my animal and lab studies, which again is not because they're not well done. It just doesn't have the target population at hand and has very little external validity. Close to the bottom, right above that, is expert opinion. And we're going to talk about that next. But close to the top, the best evidence out there that they use for medical decisions, your meta-analyses and systematic reviews. So why are opinions, everybody has one. That's the title of this slide. Our opinions are going to be created based on things like our formal education or lack of education background, our experiences in the past, our cultural background and values, our perceptions of where we are and where we're going, our environments, and all of those things create some level of bias, even if the best intentions are there. And that's where I see our veterinarians when they are trying to guide us on like a VTS application, or if we just look to our veterinarians. They're extremely smart. They are, in fact, experts. We should be listening to them. We should be listening to them when they give us their treatment orders. But at the same time, they are just as open to bias as anybody else. So if you're trying to do research on a topic, give a presentation, do a VTS application, do a case report, get external resources. Don't just rely on your veterinarians, because they are expert opinion, which is great. But unless they can also hand you an article while they're giving you their expert opinion, it's like a narrative review. It's an expert opinion. And I have actually worked with neurologists who absolutely did that to me. And I loved them for that. They gave me their opinion on something and had 5 research articles in a filing cabinet in their office. Love you for that. Most of them are not going to do that. So to Yvonne's point, she says she likes to Google to find things. Good for you, Yvonne. The Google machine is not a reliable resource, but if you go into Google and type Scholar, it will bring up Google Scholar, and then you can bring up actual scientific literature. So Google Scholar is a place to find research, but it is not in and of itself a resource. Peer-reviewed journals like JVEC and JVIM, JAVMA, all of those are really great peer-reviewed journals. And to be peer-reviewed means that me as a researcher submitted an article to be published. They take that article and they send it off to peers in my field of study. So maybe I want to write something, and then they take that article and they send it off to the AIMVT, the neurotechs there, and they're going to look over it. And they're going to send it off to the neurologist and they're going to look over it. And they're going to make sure everything looks right. So essentially, it's a way of holding researchers accountable for what they're writing and how they present it. Cochrane Reviews is another place that I love to go. Like I said, you can find me in secondary research all day. So Cochrane Reviews is another great place to find good systematic reviews and meta-analyses. Respected associations, PubMed, CDC, NCI, AVMA are also really good places, as well as reputable textbooks. But with the exception of, I love that Steven Seitel does the Science Fridays. Other than that, and that's because he gives you the actual article, do not get your information off social media. There's so much clickbait out there. Like every time I turn something on, I cannot even stand it. A lot of what's out there is clickbait. Yes, believe it or not, there are a lot of people out there that just want to make money off of your clicks. So don't get your information off social media. Again, Steven does a great job making sure that we have good research sent out there. And that dude's smart as hell. So he is not going to share an article with you guys that's garbage unless he says it's garbage. And then the same thing too is organizations trying to sell you something. I've had people send me stuff about like, oh, I read this article and it looks like you need this vitamin. They send me the article and I'm like, two paragraphs in, this woman says I have to buy her proprietary vitamins because otherwise I'm going to die of something that I've never heard of. Like that does, no, I'm sorry. I will shut it off. If they're trying to sell you something, shut it off. Done. I don't care if it's actually true or not. Just shut it off. It's not, no good. So I like to do CRAAP testing because, and I don't mean fecal floats. It's CRAAP testing. Currency, relevance, authority, accuracy, and purpose. And I do have a worksheet that I sent to Yvonne. She's going to put it up on the website so you can download it and you can use it anytime you're looking at your articles. Because I know I went over a lot of information, but this is going to help you as well. So currency, how timely is the article? We talked about there is a half-life of knowledge. My recommendation is try and use anything 10 years or newer, depending on the topic. So when I did research for this, I used a COVID example. So I'm obviously not going to use something from 10 years ago on that. Relevance, how relevant is the information with regards to your needs? Like, are you just choosing something because it substantiates your opinion? Or are you using it because it's actually relevant for your report? And the authority on it, who wrote or researched it? And what is the actual source, the source material from it? Is it obvious that maybe an organization paid for it because they are looking for, they want the information out there because it benefits their organization financially? Or is this something like the CDC who should not have any kind of vested interest like that? How reliable is the content? Which again is kind of hard to a point. And then the purpose, why did they even do it? Again, like if somebody's trying to sell me those bloody vitamins, like I'll probably never buy those vitamins at this point. It could come out in 10 years that they're like, actually these vitamins did save lives. And I'm like, well, maybe she shouldn't have put in an article like that. And we'll do a CRAAP test. Actually, we'll do the CRAAP test now. So it's really, I compare two systematic reviews. So like I said, one of the most reliable sources of information you can get is from systematic reviews and meta-analyses. So I found two systematic reviews on the efficacy of ivermectin on COVID-19 treatment. These are both, one is published by Cellular Physiology. So one is Currency, right? So one was published in July 2020. One was published in, where are you? July 2021. So you think the one from 2021 is more recent, so probably more reliable. Maybe. One comes from Cochrane Library. One comes from Cellular Physiology. Okay, so those are both peer-reviewed situations. You know, when I look at the authors, I don't know a whole lot about the authors on the Cochrane side. But for some reason, a lot of the authors on the Cellular Physiology side actually work as gynecologists. And gynecological, like some sort of reproductive med. And I'm like, why are you studying COVID-19 and ivermectin? That, like, it didn't make sense to me. It's not really smart. I just couldn't really understand why somebody who otherwise is invested in proteomics and other reproductive things is a very strange thing. But I was like, I mean, they're smart. They're a hell of a lot smarter than me. And then the purpose and both of their purpose. So but the problem is one says it's effective and one says there isn't enough evidence yet to say whether or not it's effective. I just looked at two articles that kind of passed my CRAAP test. So that's why I like to tell people it's important to be open-minded but skeptical, because I just got two reliable sources that one said it was effective and one it isn't. So if I meet somebody who disagrees with me and they present me with good evidence, I don't think they're dumb. I just think it's the evidence that they've been presented with. And we also know that at any given time, one of those is going to be proven right and one's going to be proven wrong. It's just, that's the way it is. So the other thing to think about why we want to stay open-minded above just like, hey, there's a lot of conflicting information out there and not all of it has been published as garbage, is that bias is always possible.
Yeah.
Random chance is always possible. And confounders you haven't considered are always possible.
Yep.
And that's why science changes over time, right? Like that's as we elucidate these things, we can control for them and figure it out. So like I said, like even how you get your sample to study can infer a bias. Even if you're a completely, you're a researcher who wants no bias, I put out flyers, but the only people who are going to show up are going to be people who one, saw the flyer and two, feel like doing it. Right. It's like surveys. You know what I mean? Like the only results you get are people who were willing to take the time to actually fill out the yeah. survey. And even when you talk about customer service surveys, when they're like, how did we do? The only people that respond are the ones that are pissed off. Like mm-hmm. when you had a great experience, unless it's super great, you're probably not going to respond and be like, eh, I mean, it was fine. Yeah. I'll probably go back. You can also have publication bias. So maybe these researchers did a project and it turns out they didn't find any interesting results. So they just never published it. Well, if that's the case, how can my systematic reviews be correct if this other argument, like it's, so there's that. And then, yeah, just random chance is always possible. Although that the lower that p-value is, the less likely that is. And even just confounding variables and incidental covariation, like fiber and colon cancer was an interesting one. And that was based on a truly observational study. And we ran with it. We thought it was great. It's going to cure. It's going to prevent colon cancer. I'm like, well, people are eating a lot of fiber and we're seeing a lot of colon cancer. Turns out it just was that the population that was being studied at the time, they ate a lot of fruits and vegetables and very little red meat. So it just turns out that it was the red meat or the less of red meat that meant was why they had less colon cancer. So with that, I guess kind of a review of both days or both weeks of this is that science really is a process. And yeah, I there are bad actors out there, but really active pursuit and participation in all fields that influences each other, we move forward and get closer to the truth. And that's frequently going to mean that what we thought was true at one point was wrong. And that doesn't mean we need to put up cognitive barriers and say, nope, I wasn't wrong. I couldn't have believed something wrong. Nope. Yeah, it happens. And it happens to everybody, and just get over it because you're no different than the rest of us. But be skeptical about that information, evaluate it, and then figure out if you need to do something with it. And that's because relationships really are kind of difficult and we're trying to get closer to the truth, but we're not going to get there if we just obstinately sit with our emotions and say, I refuse to believe this other thing just because science says so, because science said asbestos was fine. Like, well, yes. And then science said it wasn't. So we got that. And really the big key that we're looking at is generalizability in our research. So was the research conducted something that I can apply to the whole sample population? And although, yes, it's individual statistics are good, especially if you're quoting them in a paper, like this has a 75% success rate. Yes. But statistics out of context can sometimes also have us ignoring things like the confounding variables and various other relationship issues that we all have from time to time. And so for me, like, yes, I want you out there reading scientific literature, but my hope is that you guys do it with both an open and skeptical mind, and that the open mind isn't overly open just because you like the information that's being presented to you, but your skeptical mind isn't overly skeptical because the information doesn't align with your own biases, that we should really look at all information with a little bit of skepticism and say, does this make sense? So yeah, so that's what, unless it's paleoneurobiology, at which point I don't evaluate that information. I just take it in. I just take it in. That's really cool. Like you should, oh, so many things, so many great things.
Oh my gosh, you're so funny.
We always bring it back to dinosaurs.
Yeah. These episodes are different than we normally do. But I think it's important because it does touch on the fact that, you know, as medical professionals, you know, we do have to come at things from a scientific point of view, especially, you know, when we're getting past our, well, not even then, I was gonna say getting past our like newbie phase, but even in the newbie phase, like in school, you're having to do research papers and stuff like that. So you need to be able to evaluate it. But, as we get further along in our career, we're still doing it. And if you're presenting or if you're writing articles or any of that stuff, you definitely need to make sure that your resources are appropriate. So hopefully all this gives you tools and nuggets to be able to do that.
Yeah, in your writing, and even just, I find that learning is something we do every day. We never stop learning. Just being on the floor is learning. And my hope is that this kind of information can help people continue to learn, even if it's not in a structured conference or listening to a podcast that, or if it's not even vet med related, that you're
Right.
trying to look for something for yourself. And it is something I'm very passionate about for a number of reasons, but I do think that we need to be better about elevating each other. And this is one way that we can elevate each other is to have good evidence-based opinions and practices that, again, we can mentor and model for newer technicians and newer assistants, newer members of the veterinary community in general.
Yeah, totally agree. Totally agree. All right, guys. We'll put the links in the show notes for a lot of different stuff. And I know Christine and I will be talking about things. So
But seriously, if we're looking for some sort of a dinosaur episode, you just let me know. I don't really know how to tie it into internal medicine, but
gastroenterology, I'm telling you.
well, paleoneurobiology, I definitely have that. I because you know the endocasts, we can look at brain shapes and sizes and other
Oh.
things, but you know what? Yeah, maybe.
All right. Thank you guys for spending time with us talking about science and nerdy things, which is great. I hope you guys learned a little bit, learned some resources that you can use and understand statistics and all sorts of fun things a little bit more, right?
In the
And if you
glossary.
have questions, you can always reach out to us. I know how to get a hold of Christine, and she knows how to get a hold of me. And I'm so excited that I got to nerd out with you and talk about science,
Yes. You know, I'm
dinosaurs, and
happy to talk
chickens,
about
and
science.
everything. All right, everybody, well, have a great week. We hope you do well. We hope you continue getting your education on. And we'll talk to you soon, everybody.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you like what you heard, we'd love for you to share with someone you think might enjoy the podcast. And make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Want to give us a boost? Please leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and we'll be sure to say thank you. Find out everything about us at internalmedicineforvettechs.com. Talk to you next week. Bye.